Okay. The shear is not going to get past the word Bereshis.
Oh, good.
But I want to, if there's time, speak from two different perspectives. Not sure if we're going to get past the first one. You're all familiar with the famous first Rashi of the Torah, Omer of Yitzchak. Yitzchak had a question. Lohoya haTorah lahaschil ela meachodesh hazeh lochem. The Torah should have started from Parshas Bo, the first mitzvah, Shehim mitzvah, Nebitzonish, and Nitztava by Israel. The first mitzvah the Jewish people were given as a people was the mitzvah of HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem, Rosh Chodesh. And that should have been the beginning of the Torah. Torah is a book of mitzvahs. Start with the first mitzvah. The Lama Pasach Bereishis. Why did it start with Bereishis? Okay. Let's stop there for a second. Oh, no, let's finish the Rashi. Okay. Rashi answers, Elakoach Maisov Higidli Amo. Pasuk in Tehillim. The Rabban Shem wanted to tell the power of his deeds to his nation, that in case anyone would ever conceivably, theoretically come and say that Eretz Yisrael doesn't belong to us, that we stole it, conquered it from seven nations, and it's not really ours, and we're a bunch of thieves. So we have an answer. Bereishis Bara Elokim, God created the world. He gave Eretz Yisrael to them temporarily, took it away from them, give it to us. He has the right to give out to whoever he wants, to which his world. So therefore, we need Bereishis to let us know that we have legitimate claim to Eretz Yisrael. That's the Rashi. Some say that Rabbi Yitzchak, because it was difficult, there was no source for this Rashi. He's quoting an Omer of Yitzchak. Seemed to be some kind of medrash. And there wasn't a medrash available that they could find. Subsequently, there were medrashim that were discovered, and there was a medrash Omer of Yitzchak. But when you couldn't find it, they said that this Rabbi Yitzchak was Rashi's father. Rashi was Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, Shlomo ben Yitzchak. And they said that Rashi's father was not a very learned person, but Rashi wanted to give him kavod. So he wanted to start his commentary to the Torah with something from his father. So he said to his father, ask me a question. So the father said, right, why start the Torah start with Bereishis? Rashi said, excellent question, and that's where he started with. And that's not true. Rashi's father was a big Talmud Chacham. He quotes him a few times in the Gemara. Right? We know that Rashi's father was a tremendous father. Didn't come up with just the question, how come it starts with Bereishis? And there is a medrash that says Omer of Yitzchak. Rashi's quoting that medrash, so that's just folklore. In any case, I want to start with the question first, because I don't understand the question. And once we understand the question, then we'll try to understand the answer. Let's start with the question. I would understand this if the Torah was a book of mitzvahs, like Sefer HaMitzvos of the Rambam, the Sefer HaChinuch. The Torah starts with mitzvahs and goes through, and except Bereishis has nothing to do with mitzvahs. But once we get to that first mitzvah, it's mitzvah after mitzvah after mitzvah. It's not the case. After that first mitzvah, there's a lot of stories. Whole Sefer Shmos is full of stories. Vayikra has some stories in it. Bamidbar has a lot of stories. So the Torah is a mixture of stories and mitzvahs. So why is it more logical to start with the first mitzvah? What makes sense to me to start with the first story? Bereishis Bara, we start from the beginning. If the Torah would only be mitzvahs after HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem, then you have a question. But the Torah is constantly a mixture of narratives. Story sounds too fantastic. It's narratives and it's mitzvahs. So start with the first narrative. Start from the beginning. What's the question? The answer, I think, is to what the question is the following. That which we said, that the Torah is a mixture of stories and mitzvahs, is not true. Torah, the word Torah means instruction, to teach, to show the way. There is nothing in the Torah that isn't there to somehow teach you and show the way. There's nothing there that's just for the sake of stories. It doesn't exist. The Ramban quotes the Zohar that there are two kinds of instruction in the Torah. Some are out and out mitzvahs, and some are mitzvahs, meaning instruction of how to lead your life, that are clothed in stories. But ultimately, everything in the Torah is there to teach you. This lesson, Rav Yecheskel Avramsky teaches in the end of Megillas Esther. The second to the last sentence in Megillas Esther says the following: V'chol ma'asei sokpo gvuraso uparoshas gedulas Mordechai halohen k'suvim al divrei hayomim l'malchei modei uporas. The rest of the feats of Mordechai and the interesting things about his life you can find in the books of history, right, of the kings of Persia and Mordechai. Says Rabbi Chelsko Avramsky, whoever went and looked up those, what do you need, a maramokom, right, a what's it called, for further information about this topic, why don't you see the history books of Persia and Mordechai? These were not the history books in the library. They were the king's personal ones. Nobody would ever knock on the door and says Megillas Esther, that I should look this up, right? Could you loan me the sefer? What was the purpose of it? Why do we have to know that Mordechai's deeds are written, says Rabbi Chesko Avramsky? The Megillah is putting into perspective what Megillas Esther is. Megillas Esther is not a history book. Because if it's a history book, it's a very poor one. Because it records some events from the first year of Achashverosh's rule, and then from his third year, then from his ninth year, seventh year, 12th year, right? An event here, an event there. There's a lot of windows, a lot of blanks that could be filled in if it's Persian history. Megillas Esther has one purpose: to teach you Yiras Shamayim, to teach you about the miracle that happened, and to bring you closer to God. That's what Torah is. That's what Tanakh is. It's not history. You want history, says the Megillah? Find it somewhere else. We'll tell you if you want about the history of this period, look into the history books of Persia and Mordechai. But you're not going to find history here. You're going to find Torah. Torah, in fact, when Torah means everything, so it means everything. But sometimes it says a lot of details. Torah, mitzvos, chukim, mishpatim. So in that context, what does Torah mean? The story part of Torah. But it means instruction, guidance. Because the stories are there to instruct and to guide. They're not just there to tell you some interesting facts, historical facts. There's nothing in the Torah that's just there because it's interesting facts. It's all mitzvos. Proof of that is the following. It says that somebody who one of the things that you lose your share in the world to come is megalat ponim batorah shelo kahaloch. You uncover, literally, megalat ponim batorah shelo kahaloch means you uncover facets of the Torah that are not halachic. And the Gemara brings a example from Menashe HaMelech. Menashe used to say drosha shel dofi, foolish drushes on the Torah. And it gives an example. One of the things he said was, did Moshe Rabbeinu have nothing better to write than Timna Haisa Pilegesh Alifas Ben Esav? Tells me that there was a woman named Timna, and she was a concubine to Alifas, the son of Esav. Who cares? Moshe Rabbeinu had none better to write to tell me that Timna was a Pilegesh. So it doesn't say what his drusha was. So Rashi says, and he went on and said some foolish things. Personally, I think that was the drasha. That was the question. The Moshe Rabbeinu had nothing better to write. In other words, there's nothing really here significant. It's just a nice tidbit of history. So in case somebody ever asks you a question in trivia, you know, who was the Pilegesh of Eliphaz ben Esav? You'll know it was Timna. But there's no purpose for it. Chazal say that's not true. It teaches me something. It brings me closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Every single thing in the Torah is there to bring me closer to the Ribbono Shel'Olam. So to give you an example, before we go back to this, the Galaponim Batorah, there's a Rambam. The Rambam says like this, that the details of how Mashiach is going to come is not known and will not be known until it happens. It's not something that the prophets had a tradition, nor did the sages have a tradition of the details. Mashiach's donkey going to be black, white, green, right? Is he going to come this day, that day, another day? How is he going to come? Nobody knows. The details are not known, not by the prophets, not even by the sages, the Rambam says. And therefore, says the Rambam, person shouldn't make those details a mainstay of his learning. And then the Rambam adds one more point. Because they don't bring you to love of God or fear of God. Now, that last bit of information in the Rambam is unnecessary. The Rambam could have said, don't make these the mainstay of your learning, because you're never going to be able to come to any conclusion, because nobody knows anything about them. It's just a conjecture. So there's so many more things to learn that you can come to a conclusion. So why waste your time? Right, there's more important things to learn than things that are up to conjecture. The Rambam doesn't say that. The Rambam says an extra added thing. Because they don't bring you to love of God or fear of God. Why do you have to add that for? I think what the Rambam is saying is the following. There is no Mesorah. There's no tradition to the prophets, to the sages in these details. Why not? Why didn't God reveal these details to the prophets? Why didn't he allow the sages to find these details? So on that, the Rambam says, because they don't bring you to love of God or fear of God. And what's in the Torah is only that which will bring you to love of God and fear of God. And if it doesn't, it's not there. That's why these details aren't there. Because they have no purpose. They're interesting, 100%. But the Torah doesn't contain interesting things just for the sake of interest. It's there because it instructs you how to lead your life and get closer to God. Love and fear of God. That's it. There's nothing in the Torah. If it's there, it serves that purpose. If it's not there, it's because that purpose wouldn't be served. Therefore, the rabbi said that which Menashe said. Moshe had nothing better to write than this tidbit of history. No, we learned something. We learned love of God and fear of God from that. How so? Timna was a princess. She could have married royalty. But she wanted very much to join the family of Avraham Avinu. Because she recognized this is a special person. And she was willing to give up her princess, life as a princess, and join the family of Avraham. She came to convert, and they wouldn't accept her. Because eventually, she had Amalek as her child. And the office probably saw the seeds of Amalek within her. But she herself wanted to join the family of Avraham. So she came as a young woman to Avraham Avinu. He rejected her. She came again as a middle-aged woman to Yitzchak. And he rejected her. She came as an older woman to Yaakov. And he rejected her. And the rabbis say they did something wrong. They shouldn't have pushed her away with two hands. You never push somebody away with both hands. You push them away with the left hand and you makarev them with the right hand. They shouldn't have rejected her completely. They did. So we're suffering because of Amalek, partially because of that. That's what the rabbi said. She said, if I can't get into the front door of this family, I'm going to come through the back door. And she was willing to be a concubine to Eliphaz, the son of Esau, just to get into the family of Avraham Avinu. Even the black sheep part of the family. What do you learn from there? How great Avraham Avinu was. And you know, Avraham Avinu was such a Eved Hashem. So from there you can learn Avos Hashem and Yiras Hashem. So it's not just a tidbit of information. There's something there that if you look into it, as it says in the end of the Torah, Kilo Dover Reiku Mikem. The Torah is not something empty. And if you think it's empty, Mikem, because you don't know enough. It's your fault. If you learn more and you'll delve in deeper, you'll find out what it teaches you. Because if it's there, it's there to teach you something. It's not there merely as interesting information. to prove this point and speak about something from the book of the Parsha Bereishis also, so we get another thing in there. The Pirkei Avos, okay, in the beginning of the fifth parak, says the following: Be'asara mamoros nivra olam. The world was created with 10 utterances. The kol kach lama. Why so many? B'halo b'maymer echad yochel yibaros. God could have created the world with one utterance. It's in order to give reward to the tzaddikim who preserve a world that was created with 10 utterances, and to punish the wicked people who destroy the world with their deeds that was created with 10 utterances. That's the Mishnah we have. I think the obvious question is, how did the Tanna know that God could have created the world with one utterance? And God could do anything, but maybe the way to create worlds is to use 10 utterances. Maybe that's the way you create worlds, I don't know. God knows. It's like asking a question: how come hands have 5 fingers? They could have 4 fingers. They could have 10 fingers. Right? They could, but God knew that this is the ideal amount of fingers on a hand. So, what's the question? God could do anything, but maybe in creating the world, you need 10 utterances. So, what was the question? God could have done it with one, but what does it mean? If you look at the Avos Rav Nosson, the Avos Rav Nosson is a lengthier version of Pirkei Avos, the Brises. And there the question is phrased a little bit differently, and it sheds complete different light on what the question was. The Avos Rav Nosson says like this: Be'asara mamoros nivra ha'olam, v'chimat tzorech leboy olam b'kach. Who cares? Why do we need to know that? Not, I could have been one from God's side. For all I care, it could have been one. I don't have to know it's 10. I'm going to go create worlds. Well, it's a do-it-yourself, you know, in case you go create worlds, use 10 utterances. What do I care? How many utterances? Who needs to know? That's the question. So answer the question, I don't understand either. What do you mean, what do I need to know that for? It's nice to know. You want to know how many, you know, if everybody asks you a trivia question, how many words, utterances were created, you know it's 10. But the question is, fine, but don't put it in the Torah. If it's just an interesting tidbit of knowledge, it could be in a science book. It could be in a history book, but not in the Torah. For the Torah, there has to be a reason why it teaches you something. And the answer is, no, it teaches me. It teaches me that the world is an important place individually, and it gives more reward to the people who preserve the world and punishment to people who destroy the world. So the question points out this idea. The Torah does not record just interesting information. It has to be there to teach you something, to guide you, to make a difference in your life, to bring you to Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. To bring the point across even stronger, the next two Mishnayos are Asara Doros Me Adam Ve'ad Noach, and Asara Doros Me Noach and Avram. There are 10 generations from Adam to Noah, 10 generations from Noah to Avram. And our Mishnah says, to teach you how patient God is, that 10 generations angered him, and he didn't bring the flood till after 10 generations. So we see he's patient. We also see that he's not patient forever. There comes a time when his patience ends. 10 generations between Noah and Avram, to teach you that all those generations didn't fulfill what they were supposed to, and Avram came and got the reward of all of them. In Avos Rav Nosson, it also adds a little few more words. 10 generations from Adam to Noah. V'chimat tzorech leboy olam b'kach. Who cares? What do you mean, who cares? It's history. Fine, put it in the history book. Don't put it in the Torah. On that, the Mishnah answers, there's a reason. It teaches you something. It teaches you that God has patience. You come to love God. It teaches you his patience has a limit. It teaches you to fear God. Next generations, people don't accomplish what they're supposed to accomplish, and one person can come and turn everything around, influence those people, and get their reward for them too. Right? That's Avram Avinu. Noah, the world was destroyed. Avram saved the world. The proof that is the only reason these things are in the Torah, not for historical purposes, but to teach you that lesson, is the following. You would expect if the same Torah with the same author gives you a list of 10 generations between Adam and Noah, and then another 10 generations between Noah and Abraham, they would be very much similar, right? Parallel, exactly the same, but they're not. In the 10 generations between Adam and Noah, the Torah tells me 3 sentences about each generation: who they were and how old they were when they had their main child, the first child. Then they lived after that and had more children. And then they lived such a total of years, X total of years, and they died. 3 things: how old they were when they had their first child, how much they lived after that and had other children, how much they were total when they died, and they died. In the 10 generations between Noah and Avram, there's only 2 sentences about each generation: how old they were when they had their main child, they lived after that and had other children, and then it goes on to the next generation. It doesn't tell me some total of their life, even though you could figure it out, and it doesn't tell me they died. This goes on to the next generation. Question, no? Right? We believe the Torah was written by one author. Why did he change his style? The answer is simple, according to this. The Torah didn't write it for historical purposes. It taught it to teach me this lesson. So what's the lesson? The lesson of the first 10 generations is that God is patient. These people were wicked, and God didn't punish them until 10 generations. What do I have to know to really appreciate that? I have to know they lived. They lived a normal life. They had children. They lived a long life, and they died peacefully in their bed at 900, 800, 700 years. That brings home the lesson that God is patient. What's the lesson of the second 10 generations? There can be a lot of people, they don't do what they're supposed to do, and one person can get the reward of all of them. Do I have to know that they lived? Yeah. That there were a lot of them? Yes. That I need to know that lesson. Do I have to know that they died? No. Do I have to know when they died? No. It's not important. That's not what the lesson is all about. So the first lesson to teach me how patient God is, I need to know those 3 bits of information to bring home that lesson. The second lesson, that somebody can come and get the reward for a lot of people who don't do what they're supposed to do, I don't have to know they died at all. So it doesn't say. It's not part of the thing. It's not there. Because it doesn't teach me that lesson. It'd be interesting. One more sentence, not going to make the Torah more heavy. Torah is only what's there as mitzvos. Now let's go back to the question. So what do we ask? If the Torah would just be a bunch of mitzvahs, and it makes sense to start with the first mitzvah. But the Torah is a combination of mitzvahs and narrative stories. So start with the first story. No. When you start a book, the Torah basically is a book of mitzvahs. Either stories. The stories are mitzvahs clothed in a story. They're not just there to tell you stories. How do I know that? So there's a rule in creative writing. When you write a book, in the first few paragraphs, you should set the tone of what this book, the purpose of the book is. When somebody reads those first few paragraphs, they should know what this book is. Is it a history book? Is it a science book? Is it fiction? What's the purpose of the book? That's how you start the book. It sets the tone for the book. Says Rabbi Yitzchak, since the Torah basically is a book of mitzvahs, except some mitzvahs are guised and clothed in stories and some are open, if you start with the first story, where you could make a mistake to think it's just a story, then you may think the Torah has stories in it. But if you start with the first mitzvah and then you put the stories, you've set the pattern. You know that this is a book of mitzvahs. And all the stories that follow are just to teach you mitzvahs clothed in those stories. They're not just for information's sake. So therefore, the most logical place to start the Torah would be the first mitzvah. And then put Bereishis Bara after that. Because you've set the tone of what the Torah is. So what's the answer? So first of all, Rashi tells me the Torah did start with the first mitzvah. Torah started with the first mitzvah, Chodesh HaZavah. That's the beginning of the Torah. Listen to what Rashi says. V'hoya ha-Torah l'haschil Torah should not have started Ela Me'achodesh Azelochem Umatam Posach Bibreshis. What he should have said? Umatam Hischil Bibreshis. Should have started here. Why did it start here? Rashi's telling me no. The real beginning of the Torah is Achodesh Azelochem. This is the preface. You know, in a book, there's page one, that's the beginning of the book. Then there's Roman numeral one, that's called the preface to the book. Torah has a preface. Enochinami, the beginning of the Torah is that first mitzvah. But the preface to that is Sefer Bereishis. Pasach, it's a psicha. It's a psicha. It's a preface. So why do you need a preface for it? So Nat Rashi says, you need the preface because if we didn't have this preface, then Goyim could come and they could say that we stole Eretz Yisrael. So we have an answer, right, that God created the world and gave us Eretz Yisrael. Very nice. Doesn't answer the question. The question was, why does this have to be the beginning? Could have been the end. We didn't get Eretz Yisrael for 40 years plus another 14 years, right, that we conquered Eretz Yisrael after we got into Eretz Yisrael. So Torah was given, 40 years later we came into Eretz Yisrael, 14 years after that we conquered it. So we have plenty of time to let the Goyim know that Bereishis Bara Elokim. It didn't have to be right away at the beginning of the Torah. It could be a footnote at the end of the Torah. Right after Le'enei Kol Yisrael, a little asterisk. By the way, Bereishis Bara Elokim Es HaShemayim Es HaAretz. Now you have an answer to the Goyim. Why does it have to be at the beginning? It doesn't answer the question. The question was, why does it have to be in the beginning? It just has to be there somewhere. Why in the beginning? Second problem. Do you really think that the Goyim are going to accept that? Right. Do you think that if tomorrow the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations would get up and say, look, you know, I hate to do this, but I know there's been a lot of debate, you know, since 1947 of where Israel belongs to. I forgot to say something. Bereishis Bara Elokim Es HaShemayim Es HaAretz. You see, it says right over here, God created the world, He gave Israel to you temporarily, took it away and gave it to us. And all of the Arabs and all of the anti-Semites, they're going to get up and say, oh, why didn't you say that long ago? We could have saved so much trouble. We didn't know that. Right? Oh, fine, right. So it's yours, no problem. I doubt very much. It would be nice if he tried it, but I doubt if that's going to help. Thirdly, okay, so I know why we need Bereishis. Up until by Lech Lecha, where God gives Avram Avinu Eretz Yisrael. What do you need? Vayerech HaYisora told us, Vayetze, Vayishlach, Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, Vayichi. Who needs all of that? I just need those first things to tell me that we have a claim to Eretz Yisrael. You don't need the rest of it. Another question. And this is a major question. If God was so concerned that we look like thieves because we stole Eretz Yisrael, but it's more than that. We're not just thieves. We are murderers. Hmm. We are people who practiced ethnic cleansing. Right? We are genocide. We kill men, women, and children, little babies in their cribs to get Eretz Yisrael. We had to annihilate the seven nations that were there. No mercy. True. Yeshua wrote letters before we came into Eretz Yisrael, and he told them that we have a mitzvah to annihilate you. If you choose to leave, we won't touch you. So if you leave, you know, what's it called? A transfer. I go somewhere else, we're okay with that. And one of the nations did that. The Girgashi left Eretz Yisrael. They took Yeshua seriously. They did not want to be annihilated. And they went to Africa. The Ponovich Rav used to say, they went to Cape Town. And he said that is because the Rabbanu Shem gave them a land as beautiful as Eretz Yisrael. He says that if they went to Africa already, they must have gone to Cape Town. He said that's so they went, they got something in return for Eretz Yisrael. The rest of them said no, we'll take our chances, and they were annihilated. But still we annihilated them. We killed men, women, and children, little babies. Okay. And how can we do that? The answer is God told us to. And God has the right to tell us to do anything. But if God is so concerned that we're going to look like thieves, and even worse than thieves, cold-blooded murderers, then why did God give us Eretz Yisrael the way that he did? In such a suspicious way. To go conquer seven nations that were there, kill their men, women, and children, and take the land. If God's so concerned that we don't look like thieves, forget about Bereishis Bara Elokim. I got a better idea. Give us the land in a way that's very innocent. I could think of some ways, and God, I'm sure, could think of ways. I'll tell you two ways if he needs advice. I could have given advice. First way, he could have made all the Goyim who lived in Eretz Yisrael have heart attacks and strokes at the same time. Everyone, babies, men, women, right? God could do that. Right. Bring a plague.
A plague.
Wipe them out. We come in, all these dead people. We do a big mitzvah, we bury them all, right? Say Kaddish for them all, right? We're not murderers anymore. We didn't conquer any land. Everybody was dead. We just took over the land. And we did such a nice favor. We buried these people. We said Kaddish for them. No more question. Or, there's another possibility. You think that's too miraculous? I got a very nice, simple, natural way. You make the economic conditions in Israel, in Canaan, so bad that all the Canaanim leave, go to New York, open falafel stores, right, drive cabs, and what's it called? And there's no more Canaanim. We've come into a land, nobody's there. Everybody left. Right? They all got green cards. They all left. Right? And there's nobody left. So we walk in, all these people are gone, and we just take over the land. Why did God give us a land and make us fight these people, conquer them, kill their men, women, and children, and then we have a problem, but you look like a bunch of thieves that you took land from somebody else. So I'm going to give you the book of Bereishis, and that's going to solve the problem. Now everybody knows Bereishis Bara Elokim. Doesn't make sense. So let's understand why. First of all, the lesson is not for the goyim. Nothing's going to convince them. It doesn't say koach ma'isov higid la'amim in order to give them Eretz Yisrael. It says koach ma'isov higid la'amo. God told us. We should know that we're not thieves and murderers. Okay, we should know. So the lesson's not for them. It's for us. Why? Why do we need that lesson? And why do we need it as a preface to the Torah? The idea is the following. Torah needs a basis to it. Meaning, it's very difficult to keep the mitzvahs of the Torah if you don't have the right outlook on life. You don't have the right perspective on life. You don't have the right values and standards. Okay, and that has to precede the mitzvahs of the Torah. Because if you don't have... I'll give you two examples. One that applies to general, one applies to women, more specifically. Take two boys in Chutz Laaretz, because it applies more in the Chutz Laaretz that apply here in Eretz Israel. Two high school boys, yeshiva boys, high school. And they have to decide what they're going to do after high school. They have two possibilities. They could go on to college and learn part-time and get a college education so they can have a parnasa. Or they can go on and learn Torah in a yeshiva full-time. Okay. Without getting into the nitty-gritty of whatever, I'm going to make my marshal black and white. There's no shiva. These two boys, without question, if they continue learning full-time, will be the next two leaders of the Jewish people. How do I know? I made up the marshal. I can make up the marshal any way I want. So it's for sure. Okay? For sure. If they go on and go to college, get a parnasa, be very fine people, nice balabatim, but they won't. The Klal Yisrael will be missing the next Rabbi Kiva Eger and the next Chazon Ish. That's it. They won't exist. They won't be. their Rebbeim see the potential they have, and they tell them, you are, stay by learning. You, the Klal Yisrael needs you. You could be the next two leaders of the Jewish people. Okay. Their parents, uncles, aunts, right? Other people tell them, yeah, you got to make a parnasa, right? You could be a very fine, frum Jew, nice Talmud Chacham, go get a parnasa, go to college, whatever. They have to make a decision. Okay. And in this situation, right, the decision for these two specific boys is to stay by learning, because Klal Yisrael needs them. They are going to be the leaders of the next generation. One of these boys grew up in the society we're familiar with. Okay, go to Times Square, tap a goy on the shoulder, and say, in one word or one sentence, could you tell me what success is? What do you think he'll say? Money. An S with two lines in it. That is success. Money. Money means you could have power, you could have pleasure, you could have whatever you want, then you have a successful life. You're rich, you're successful. And everything in his life taught him that. He saw a big billboard, right, that you buy this car, you'll be successful. Right? You can see all the accoutrements of success. This is the car that you buy, you'll be a successful. This is a cigarette you smoke, you'll be successful. This is everything. All the advertisements, everything was geared to that. Even though he's been in yeshiva, you know, for years, and he knows deep down that that's not what success is, the Torah, right? Torah's idea of a successful life has nothing to do with how much money you have, right? But his knee-jerk reaction, reflex, when you mention success, is money. Then he has to think. And second is, but I know that's not really what it is. But that's what hits him first. The other boy was brought up in a society that doesn't exist anywhere, but could exist, will exist, maybe did exist. He was brought up in a total Torah environment where success meant having good midos, having a lot of mitzvahs, knowing a lot of Torah, getting the biggest olam haba you could get. And everything was geared to that. All the advertisements and all the billboards and everything on the radio or whatever told him, what's it called? Buy this car, you'll have a good midos or whatever. That's, you know, that's what he saw. Right? Successful, meaning when you have a lot of mitzvahs, you have a lot of, this is the car to buy, this is the cigarette, this, whatever it may be. But that's he was bombarded with that message. So his knee-jerk reflex to success is that kind of life. Both of these boys are going to have to make a decision. Okay, the first one is going to have a hard time making that decision because he's going to have to give up success to stay by Torah. And that's not easy. So he has a real challenge. The second one has no big challenge. Why in the world would I want to give up success to go to college? Success to me is Torah. So if you have the right basis, the Torah is easy to keep. If you have the wrong basis, it's very difficult. Rabbi Hollander Zatzal, so a young Israel rabbi in Miami, Nifter a few years ago, I saw once he wrote the following. He said, people who have a Torah outlook on life, they have Torah values and Torah standards, so they have 613 mitzvahs to keep. But people whose values and standards and outlook on life is basically secular, but they're frum. They don't have 613 mitzvahs. They have 613 problems. Because every mitzvah is a problem that conflicts with their way of life. So they may keep it, but it's a problem. So before you can have a mitzvah, let me give you another example. Another example is, you're familiar with the fact that there are many women who feel disenfranchised, discriminated against by God, nonetheless, because he didn't let them put on tefillin, he doesn't let them get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to daven with a minyan, right, and to have to sit and learn Torah all the time and be worried about bittul Torah, and they can't wear talis, they can't be a shliach tzibur, they can't read from the Torah, and they feel that their connection to God is stymied, right? They blame it usually on the rabbis, but the truth is, if you believe the Torah is divine, you only have God to blame. So they find all ways of correcting God's mistake. Okay, they put on tefillin and they wear the talis and they go to the Kosel Maravi and sing their kishkes out on Rosh Chodesh or whatever to feel closer to God. Okay. Now, I want to make a very complex issue too simple, but Mamaisa, I find it very difficult to believe that what motivates these women, mainly, well, I don't know if what they think motivates them, but what really motivates them is their real feeling of wanting to get closer to God, and that they're just discriminated against, and God just pushes them out of having a connection with Him. I'll tell you why I find that hard. Because that would imply that our grandmothers, great-grandmothers, right, great women in Jewish history, who this didn't never bothered, really weren't concerned about getting closer to God. They were satisfied making their cholent and chocolate cakes or whatever, and they weren't thinking about God too much, so it didn't bother them that they put on a tefillin and they didn't wear a talis and they couldn't read from the Torah. The Chazon Ish's mother, that never bothered her. She wasn't interested in God. She was interested in her kitchen. Right? So that's why it didn't bother her. I find that very difficult. Because if you ever read about the Chazon Ish's life, you realize that his mother probably was the reason he became the Chazon Ish. And she was very much connected to God. She never put on tefillin. She never sang her kishkas out at the Kosel Maravi on Rosh Chodesh. But she had a tremendous connection with God. It didn't bother her that she couldn't do these things. So it's hard for me to believe that these women are so holy and so spiritual that it didn't bother the Chazon Ish's mother, but it bothered them. Hard to believe. So what is it? Why is it a bother these women? It didn't bother them. Tell you why. Again, let me give you a scenario. Somebody came to you with a magic wand and said, I could give you, man or woman, doesn't make a difference, I could give you two careers just with the wave of my magic wand. In both of them you'll earn the same money. Okay. One of them is you will be a movie star. Everybody will know who you are. You'll come onto the screen, everybody knows your name, your picture, whatever, you're the star of the movie. Or you could be a very talented person, but you're not the star of the movie. You are behind the scenes. You're the person who makes the scenery, the writes the songs, whatever. Nobody knows what you look like. Your name comes on at the end of the movie, you know, in little print that nobody ever bothers to read anyway. But you'll be much more talented and you'll make the same money. Which do you think most people would choose? No? The first one. Why? Because in a secular world, fame is a value to itself. Years ago in Cleveland, I read of a person who murdered his neighbor. And the police could not find a motive. The guy didn't even know the other guy. He just one day walked into his apartment and murdered him. And they looked, what's the motive? Why did this guy murder his neighbor? And finally, he said, he admitted that he did it, and he explained why he did it. He said he wanted to be famous. And he knew that murderers get their picture on the first page.
Infamous.
What?
Became infamous.
Right? No, to him, that was fame. And he got his wish. He couldn't figure out any other way of becoming famous. How was he get his picture in the paper? He got his picture in the paper. The people were talking about him. He got a lot of publicity. That was what he wanted. Okay, that's obviously extreme. But in the secular world, being famous is out there in the forefront, is a value to itself. In a Torah world, not only is it not a value, but it could be it's not even... there's nothing wrong with being famous, but it's not necessarily a positive thing. The Chazon Ish, let's go back to him. For the first 40 years of his life, he sat in a Beis Medrash, learned with a Chavrusa, and nobody knew really who he was. the Rav of Vilna, Reb Chaim Ozer, knew who he was, and he made him promise that he wouldn't reveal whatever. He wrote a sefer that captured the Torah world, the Chazon Ish. He didn't write his name on the sefer. He didn't even hint his last name, just Ish, Avram Yeshaya. Not the Kuf, the Korelitz. And in the beginning, people didn't know who wrote the sefer. He didn't want any fame. Why? Because from a Torah standpoint, that which is more hidden in the background is better. Right? That which is more tzanua. Ein ha-bracha shora, ela b'dover shesami b'na'ayim. Brachas on something hidden from view. What was the most important place in the world? No? Most important place in the world? Beis HaMikdash? What was the most important place in the Beis HaMikdash? The Kodesh HaKadosh, the Holy of Holies. Do you think there was ever a spread in better homes and gardens on the decor of the Holy of Holies? I guarantee you there wasn't. Nobody ever saw it. Except once a year, the Kohen Gadol went in there, and even he didn't see it because it was a smoke screen. Nobody ever saw the place. And that was the holiest place in the world. So you see that being hidden in the background, you know, from a Torah standpoint, is much better than having to be in the forefront. Therefore, take a woman who basically lives in a secular world and influenced, again, by her knee-jerk, reflexive values and standards, secular standards, fame, being in the forefront is a positive thing. And the Torah pushes her to the back. No, you can't read the Torah. You have to stand behind a mechitza, right? You don't put on tefillin. You don't put on a talis. How could she not feel disenfranchised? How could she not feel discriminated against? I want to be in the front. Why should I be in the back? Why should I be on the side, behind the curtain? Right? I want to be there in the limelight. But a woman who's brought up with Torah values and not influenced by those secular values at all, her knee-jerk reflex is, of course I want to be in the background. Right? Their men should be able to complain, not the women. So for somebody who bases their Torah observance on Torah values and standards, the Torah is an easy thing to do. For those who base it on other values and standards, they're almost impossible. That every mitzvah is a conflict with your values and your standards. Therefore, what's the purpose of Eretz Yisrael? Why did God give us Eretz Yisrael? So we could create a society based on Torah values and standards, separate from the world, not influenced by their values and their standards and their way of life, so we could create a society where Torah and mitzvahs are endemic to the society. That's what Eretz Yisrael is all about. A place where we can keep the Torah and mitzvahs not isolated from the world, but insulated from the world. Where we have our own value system, our own basis, and then we can keep the Torah, all the Torah in Eretz Yisrael, naturally. That's the purpose of Eretz Yisrael. Comes along the Rabbanu Shem, says, I want to give you a Torah with mitzvahs in it. But before you can start the first mitzvah, you need a preface. You need to have the right values and standards. You have to know that your values and standards depend on me, not on the world out there. If you base your values and standards on the world out there, you're a bunch of thieves. Because in their eyes, you stole Eretz Yisrael. And not only that, you don't need Eretz Yisrael. Because the whole purpose of Eretz Yisrael is to create a place where you base your values and standards on me, and are then able to keep the Torah in a most natural way. If you're basing your values and standards, you don't have a claim to Eretz Yisrael. You don't need it. Because basically in their eyes, according to their standards and values, you're a bunch of thieves and murderers. You only have a claim to Eretz Yisrael if you base your values and standards on me. That's why he gave it to us in such a suspicious way. Because if you accept the fact that God calls the shots, then you're not murderers, you're not thieves, you did what God said. It's the only thing that separates between that and Hitler. Hitler did what he wanted, and we did what God said. If Hitler thinks God told him, we'll wait till see to the end who God told what. But if God told us, he has the right to tell us whatever he wants. He gave these people life. He can take it away from them. And he can tell us to take it away. If God didn't tell us that, then we're a bunch of murderers. So if you base your values and standards on God, then you have a claim to Eretz Yisrael, and you need Eretz Yisrael. And then it serves its purpose. And then you can start with the Torah. Because then you can have mitzvahs that are like round things on a round base. But if you don't make your standards and values dependent on me, you make them dependent on the world, then you have no claim to Eretz Yisrael. In their eyes, you're a bunch of ganovim and a bunch of murderers. And you don't need Eretz Yisrael because it serves no purpose to you. And then you can't even get to start in the Torah. Because every mitzvah I give you, even if you want to keep it, is going to be a challenge and a problem because it's not going to fit your lifestyle. It's not going to fit your values and standards. So before the first mitzvah could start, you need a preface to the Torah. The preface is that we should know that we have a claim to Eretz Yisrael, why we need Eretz Yisrael, and that claim is only if we base our standards and values and perspective on life on God, and not on this, on the world, not on the secular world. That's what Rashi is saying. The Torah should have started from the first mitzvah, and it really does. But then it was needed a preface to the Torah that we should know we have a claim to Eretz Yisrael. And that claim to Eretz Yisrael depends on who we base our standards and values. Base it on the world, you don't have any claim. Base it on God, you have a claim. And then that's what Eretz Yisrael serves, a purpose to create a society where keeping the Torah is natural. Not where every mitzvah is a problem because it conflicts with your way of life, with your standards, your values, and perspective of life. Okay, I think that's what the Rashi means. Okay, we didn't have a chance to get to the second thing. The second thing was, why is the Torah start with a beis and not an aleph? But Amir Tzashem, at some point we will get to that also.